Robert Langdon stood outside Archive Vault 9 and read the labels on the stacks. Brahe, Clavius, Copernicus, Kepler, Newton. As he read the names again, he felt a sudden uneasiness. Here are the scientists, but where is Galileo? He turned to Vittoria, who was checking the contents of a nearby vault. I found the right theme, but Galileo's missing. No, he isn't, she said, frowning as she motioned to the next vault. He's over here, but I hope you brought your reading glasses because this entire vault is his. Langdon ran over. Vittoria was right. Every indicator tab in Vault 10 carried the same keyword. Il processo Galileano. Langdon let out a low whistle, now realizing why Galileo had his own vault. The Galileo affair! He marveled, peering through the glass at the dark outlines of the stacks. The longest and most expensive legal proceeding in Vatican history. 14 years and 600 million lira. It's all here. Inside the hermetic vault, which opened when he pressed a large yellow button, the air was thinner than Langdon had anticipated. Oxygen is an oxidant, he told Vittoria, so hermetic vaults contain very little of it. It's a partial vacuum inside. Your breathing will feel strained. He reached into the box beside the door and extracted some white cotton gloves. Formal affair? Vittoria asked. Finger acid. We can't handle the documents without them. Put on a pair and let's get going. Mickey's ticking. BBC reporter Gunther Glick stared at the cell phone in his hand for 10 seconds before he finally hung up. Chinita Macri studied him from the back of the van. What happened? Who was that? Glick turned, feeling like a child who had just received a Christmas gift he feared was not really for him. What if I told you 4 cardinals have been kidnapped and are going to be murdered at different churches tonight? I'd say you're being hazed by someone at the office with a sick sense of humor. What if I told you we were going to be given the exact location of the first murder? I'd want to know who the hell you just talked to. He didn't say, but he was very intent to know if I had a cameraman. Videographer, Macri corrected. And if we could transmit live, Glick added. It was Vittoria who finally struck gold near the back of the vault. Her throaty voice called out, Diagramma delle verità. Langdon dashed to join her. Where? Vittoria pointed, and Langdon immediately realized why they had not found it earlier. The manuscript was in a folio bin, not on the shelves. Folio bins were a common means of storing unbound pages. The label on the front of the container left no doubt about the contents. Diagramma della Verita, Galileo Galilei, 1639. Langdon dropped to his knees, his heart pounding. Diagramma. He gave her a grin. Nice work. Help me pull out this bin. Vittoria knelt beside him and they heaved. The metal tray on which the bin was sitting rolled toward them on casters, revealing the top of the container. So open it, Vittoria said. Langdon didn't need any encouragement. He unsnapped the latch and lifted the lid. Inside, flat on the floor of the bin, lay a black duck cloth pouch. Reaching in with both hands and keeping the pouch horizontal, Langdon lifted it out of the bin. I expected a treasure chest, Vittoria said. Looks more like a pillowcase. Follow me, he said, holding the bag before him like a sacred offering. Langdon walked to the center of the vault where he found the customary glass-topped archival exam table. He laid the pouch on the table and unbuttoned the opening. The muted yellow papyrus inside left no doubt in his mind as to its age and authenticity. But, excluding the inevitable fading, the document was in superb condition. Heliocentricity, Vittoria said, translating the heading on Folio 1. She scanned the text. Looks like Galileo renouncing the geocentric model once and for all. Forget it, Langdon said. We're looking for math, numbers. what the Illuminati called the pure language. But as Langdon flipped through a dozen or so pages, there were no numbers, no diagrams, nothing. "I thought this guy was a mathematician," Vittoria said. "This is all text. Maybe the clue isn't mathematical."
"Lingua pura, the pure language," Langdon insisted. "What else would it be?"
He flipped the stack back over to the beginning.
"It's in here somewhere, I'm sure."
Somewhere beneath Rome, the dark figure prowled down a stone ramp into the underground tunnel. Up ahead, the frightened voices of grown men called out in vain, echoing in the cramped spaces. As he rounded the corner, he saw them, exactly as he had left them. Four old men, terrified, sealed behind rusted iron bars in a stone cubicle.
"Now then," the killer said, "who will be first?"
"Wait a minute," Vittoria said, still inside Archive Vault 10. "This page has a footnote. It's obscured in a crease." Langdon tried to see what she was looking at, but all he could make out was the page number in the upper right-hand corner of the sheet, Folio 5. Langdon wondered if the Illuminati would have chosen page 5 on which to hide their clue. He sensed a tiny ray of hope. "Is the footnote mathematical?" Vittoria shook her head. "Text. Only one line. I think you'll want to hear this, though." Langdon sensed excitement in her voice. "Go ahead." Squinting at the portfolio, Vittoria read the line. "The path of light is laid, the sacred test." As the words sank in, Langdon realized they were as direct a reference to the path of illumination as he could imagine. Path of light, sacred test. His head felt like an engine revving on bad fuel. "Are you sure of the translation?" Vittoria hesitated. "Actually, it's not technically a translation. The line is written in English." For an instant, Langdon thought the acoustics in the chamber had affected his hearing.
"English? What is English doing in an Italian book?"
Vittoria shrugged. She too was looking tipsy.
"Maybe English is what they meant by the lingua pura. It's considered the international language of science. It's all we speak at CERN."
"But this was in the 1600s, Langdon argued. "Nobody spoke English in Italy. Not even..."
He stopped short, realizing what he was about to say.
"Not even the clergy. They considered English a polluted freethinker's language for profane men like Chaucer and Shakespeare."
"So you're saying maybe Galileo considered English la lingua pura because it was the one language the Vatican did not control?"
"In a word, yes."
"Uh-oh," Vittoria said. Langdon focused to see her rotating the folio upside down. He felt a knot in his gut. "Not again. There's no way that line is an ambigram."
"No, it's not an ambigram, but it's..."
She kept turning the document, 90 degrees at every turn.
"It's what?"
Vittoria looked up.
"It's not the only line. There's a different line on every margin. Top, bottom, left, and right. I think it's a poem."
She kept turning the page in quarter turns.
"Huh, you know what?
Galileo didn't even write this."
"What?"
"The poem is signed John Milton."
"John Milton?"
The influential English poet who wrote Paradise Lost was a contemporary of Galileo's and a savant who conspiracy buffs put at the top of their list of Illuminati suspects.
"Milton knew Galileo, didn't he?" Vittoria said. "Maybe he wrote the poem as a favor."
Langdon clenched his teeth as he took the sheath document. Leaving it flat on the table, he read the line at the top. Then he rotated the page 90 degrees, reading the line in the right margin. Another twist, and he read the bottom. Another twist, the left. A final twist completed the circle. There were four lines in all. The first line Vittoria had found was actually the third line of the poem. Utterly agape, he read the four lines again, clockwise in sequence, top, right, bottom, left. When he was done, he exhaled. There was no doubt in his mind.
"You found it, Miss Vetra."
She smiled tightly.
"Good. Now can we get the hell out of here?"
Langdon and Vittoria exploded onto the courtyard outside the secret archives. The fresh air felt like a drug as it flowed into Langdon's lungs.
"Hurry,"
Vittoria said, holding the folio in her hand and striding at a half-jog across Via Borgia in the direction of Olivetti's office. "If any water gets on that papyrus," Langdon said.
"Calm down. When we decipher this thing, we can return their sacred folio 5.
As they left the courtyard, Vittoria held out the folio for Langdon.
"You think you can decipher it?"
Langdon took the document carefully in his hands. Without hesitation, he slipped it into one of the breast pockets of his tweed jacket, out of the sunlight and dangers of moisture.
"I deciphered it already," he said, moving faster now. "I know where the first killing is going to happen. We need to warn Olivetti."
Vittoria closed in on him.
"How could you already know?"
Langdon quoted from memory.
"From Santi's earthly tomb with demon's hole, cross Rome, the mystic elements unfold. The path of light is laid, the sacred test. Let angels guide you on your lofty quest." "From Santi's earthly tomb," he repeated in his mind.
The poem was crystal clear about that. The path of illumination began at Santi's tomb. From there, across Rome, the markers blazed the trail.
"Who is Santi?"
Vittoria sounded suddenly excited.
"And where is his tomb?"
"Santi," Langdon said, "is the last name of the great Renaissance master, Raphael."
"So the path starts at Raphael's tomb?"
"It actually makes perfect sense," Langdon said as they rushed on. "The Illuminati could have chosen Raphael's tomb as a kind of tribute." Langdon also knew that Raphael, like many other religious artists, was a suspected closet atheist. Vittoria slipped the folio carefully back in Langdon's pocket.
"So where is he buried?"
Langdon took a deep breath. "Believe it or not, Raphael's buried in the Pantheon, the oldest church in Rome."
"But how does this guy expect to kill someone at the famous Pantheon and get away unnoticed? It would be impossible."
Langdon threw her a crooked smile. "As impossible as kidnapping 4 cardinals from Vatican City?" The 4 unmarked Alfa Romeo 155 T-Sparks roared down Via dei Coronari like fighter jets off a runway. The vehicles carried 12 plain-clothed Swiss guards, armed with Pardini semi-automatics, local radius nerve gas containers, and long-range stun guns. Sitting in the passenger seat of the lead car, Olivetti turned backward toward Langdon and Vittoria. His eyes were filled with rage.
"I have just removed a dozen of my best men from Vatican City on the eve of conclave. And I have done this to stake out the Pantheon, based on the testimony of some American I have never met, who has just interpreted a 400-year-old poem."
Langdon resisted the urge to pull Folio 5 from his pocket and wave it in Olivetti's face.
"All I know is that the information we found refers to Raphael's tomb, and Raphael's tomb is inside the Pantheon."
"Ridiculous," Olivetti snapped. "Let me tell you something about the Pantheon. The Pantheon is a single room, a circular cell made of stone and cement. It has one entrance, no windows, one narrow entrance. That entrance is flanked at all times by no less than 4 armed Roman policemen who protect this shrine from artifices, anti-Christian terrorists, and gypsy tourist scams."
Langdon nodded.
"I know it's improbable. You're preaching to the converted, Olivetti."
The director of CERN, Maximilian Kohler, opened his eyes to the cool rush of chromalin and leukotriene in his body, dilating his bronchial tubes and pulmonary capillaries. He was breathing normally again. He found himself lying in a private room in the CERN infirmary, his wheelchair beside the bed. He took stock, examining the paper robe they had put him in. His clothing was folded on the chair beside the bed. Outside, he could hear a nurse making the rounds. He lay there a long minute, listening. Then, as quietly as possible, he pulled himself to the edge of the bed and retrieved his clothing. Struggling with his dead legs, he dressed himself. Then he dragged his body onto his wheelchair. Langdon felt himself sweating now, in his Harris tweed in the back seat of the Alfa Romeo, which was idling 3 blocks from the Pantheon. Vittoria sat beside him, looking engrossed by Olivetti, who was transmitting his final orders through his walkie-talkie. "Deployment will be an 8-point hem," the commander said. "Full perimeter, with a bias on the entry." Vittoria looked stunned, almost angry. "Commander, isn't anyone going inside?" Olivetti turned. "Inside? Inside the Pantheon, where this is supposed to happen." "Too risky at this point," Olivetti said. "Nonsense, I'll go myself. I'll pretend I'm a tourist." Langdon turned and stared at her. Olivetti shook his head. "Absolutely not." But Vittoria had endured enough inaction. "I'm going." She opened her door and got out. Olivetti dropped his walkie-talkie and jumped out of the car, circling in front of Vittoria. Langdon got out, too. What the hell is she doing? Olivetti blocked Vittoria's way. "Miss Vetra, your instincts are good, but I cannot let a civilian interfere. We would have no lines of communication with you. I can't let you carry a walkie-talkie. It would give you away." Vittoria reached in her shirt pocket and produced her cell phone. "Plenty of tourists carry phones." Olivetti frowned. Vittoria unsnapped the phone and mimicked a call. "Hi, honey, I'm standing in the Pantheon. You should see this place." She snapped the phone shut and motioned to the cell phone on Olivetti's belt. "What's your number?" Olivetti did not reply for at least 10 seconds. Finally, he nodded. "Program this number." He began dictating digits. Vittoria programmed her phone and snapped it shut. "Thank you, sir." Langdon felt a sudden, unexpected surge of protective instinct. "Wait a minute," he said to Olivetti. "You can't send her in there alone. It's dangerous." "You're right," Olivetti said. "Even my best men don't work alone. Besides, the masquerade will be more convincing with both of you anyway. Do either of you know how to use a gun?" Vittoria held her hand out. "I can tag a breaching porpoise from 40 meters off the bow of a rocking ship." "Good." Olivetti handed the gun to her. "You'll have to conceal it." Vittoria glanced down at her shorts. Then she looked at Langdon. "Oh, no, you don't," Langdon thought, but Vittoria was too fast. She opened his jacket and inserted the weapon into one of his breast pockets. It felt like a rock dropping into his coat, his only consolation being that diagramma was in the other pocket. The Swiss Guard staging room is located adjacent to the Corpo di Vigilanza barracks and is used primarily for planning the security surrounding papal appearances and public Vatican events. Today, however, it was being used for something else. The man addressing the assembled task force was the second in command of the Swiss Guard, Captain Elias Rocher. Rocher was a barrel-chested man with soft, putty-like features. His men called him Orso, grizzly bear. They sometimes joked that Rocher was the bear who walked in the viper's shadow. Commander Olivetti was the viper. Rocher was just as deadly as the viper, but at least you could see him coming. "We will be killing power in selected areas," Rocher was saying, "to eradicate extraneous magnetic interference. We will move in teams of 4. We will wear infrared goggles for vision.
Reconnaissance will be done with traditional bug sweepers, recalibrated for sub-3-ohm flux fields. Any questions? None. Godspeed, men. As Langdon and Vittoria rounded the corner into Piazza della Rotonda, the Pantheon rose before them. A scattering of tourists with video cameras wandered the area. Outside the entrance, four armed Roman policemen stood at attention, just as Olivetti had predicted.
"Looks pretty quiet," Vittoria said. "What time is it?"
Langdon checked his watch. 7:50. 10 minutes till showtime.
"Hope these guys are good," Vittoria said,
eyeing the scattered tourists entering the Pantheon.
"If anything happens inside that dome, we'll all be in the crossfire."
The air inside the Pantheon was cool and damp, heavy with history. The sprawling ceiling hovered overhead as though weightless. The 141-foot unsupported span, larger even than the cupola at St. Peter's. Above them, the famous circular hole in the roof glowed with a narrow shaft of evening sun.
The oculus, Langdon thought. The demon's hole.
They had arrived.
"Where's Raphael's tomb?" Vittoria asked.
Langdon thought for a moment, then motioned to an ornate funerary across the dome and to the left.
"I think that's Raphael's, over there."
Vittoria scanned the rest of the room.
"I don't see anyone who looks like an assassin about to kill a cardinal. Shall we look around? I'll take the left arc."
She indicated the left half of the circumference.
"You go right. See you in 180 degrees.
She moved off. As Langdon moved slowly to his right, Vittoria was already immersed in her own search. Standing all alone for the first time since she had heard the news of her father, she felt the stark reality of the last 8 hours closing in around her. She was plagued with guilt to think that it was her invention that had enabled the antimatter to be transported, her canister that was now counting down inside the Vatican. Oddly, the only thing that felt right in her life at the moment was the presence of a total stranger, Robert Langdon. She found an inexplicable refuge in his eyes, like the harmony of the oceans she had left behind early that morning. She was glad he was there. Not only had he been a source of strength and hope for her, Langdon had used his quick mind to render this one chance to catch her father's killer. Vittoria breathed deeply as she continued her search, moving around the perimeter. She approached the tomb of Raphael Santi. Studying the grave, she read the one-sentence descriptive plaque beside Raphael's tomb. Then she read it again. A moment later, she was dashing in horror across the floor.
"Robert! Robert!"
Langdon was preparing to examine another niche when suddenly someone grabbed him from behind. It was Vittoria. She was breathless and tugging at his arm.
"Robert," she managed, "we're in trouble, big trouble. The dates don't match."
"What dates don't match?"
"Raphael's tomb. He wasn't buried here until 1759, a century after Diagramma was published."
Langdon stared at her, trying to make sense of the words.
"No," he replied. "Raphael died in 1520, long before Diagramma." "Yes, but he wasn't buried here until much later. I just read it. Raphael's body was relocated to the Pantheon in 1758. It was part of some historic tribute to eminent Italians."
As the words settled in, Langdon felt like a rug had just been yanked out from under him.
"When that poem was written," Vittoria declared, "Raphael's tomb was somewhere else. Back then, the Pantheon had nothing at all to do with Raphael."
Langdon could not breathe.
"But that means..." "Yes, it means we're in the wrong place."
Langdon tried to think, but his mind refused to engage.
"Santi's earthly tomb with demon's hole. What the hell is it? Think!"
Suddenly he got it.
"Santi designed the tomb," he said. Vittoria stared at him.
What? It's not a reference to where Raphael is buried. It's referring to a tomb he designed for someone else.
Yes? Vittoria prompted.
But who?
Langdon glanced around wildly, fixing on an Italian tour guide in conversation with an elderly American couple. He reached the man in three long strides, closely followed by Vittoria.
Did Raphael design any tombs that had a demon's hole?
He asked without preamble. The guide scratched his head.
Actually, I'm sorry, but if by demon's hole you mean a burial cavity underneath another tomb, I can only think of one. It's called the Chigi Chapel, tomb of Agostino Chigi and his brother, wealthy patrons of the arts and sciences.
Sciences? Langdon said, exchanging looks with Vittoria.
Where?
Vittoria asked.
About a mile north, in the church of Santa Maria del Popolo. Some people still call it by its original name, Cappella della Terra.
Chapel of the Land? Langdon asked.
No, Vittoria said, heading for the door. Chapel of the Earth.
Vittoria Vetra whipped out her cell phone as she dashed into Piazza della Rotonda.
Commander Olivetti, she said, this is the wrong place.
Olivetti sounded bewildered.
Wrong? What do you mean? The first altar of science is at the Chigi Chapel.
Where? Now Olivetti sounded angry.
But Mr. Langdon said, Santa Maria del Popolo, 1 mile north. Get your men over there now. We've got 4 minutes.
Langdon and Vittoria's taxi completed the 1 mile sprint up the wide Via della Scrofa in just over a minute. They skidded to a stop on the south side of the Piazza del Popolo just before 8. Not having any lira, Langdon overpaid the driver in U.S. dollars. He and Vittoria jumped out. Langdon was still in shock over his mistake at the Pantheon. With a cursory glance at this square, however, his sixth sense was already tingling. The piazza seemed subtly filled with Illuminati significance. Not only was it laid out in a perfectly elliptical shape, but dead center stood a towering Egyptian obelisk, a square pillar of stone with a distinctively pyramidal tip. The church of Santa Maria del Popolo stood out like a misplaced battleship, askew at the base of a hill on the southeast corner of the piazza. Langdon's thoughts were a blur as they raced toward the edifice. The gun felt awkward in his pocket. The church's front stairs were ventaglio, a welcoming, curved fan. Ironic in this case because they were blocked with scaffolding, construction equipment, and a sign warning, Costruzione, non entrare. Langdon realized that a church closed for renovation meant total privacy for a killer. Not like the Pantheon. No fancy tricks needed here, only to find a way in. Vittoria slipped without hesitation between the sawhorses and headed up the staircase.
Vittoria, Langdon cautioned, if he's still in there.
Vittoria didn't seem to hear. She ascended the main portico to the church's sole wooden door. Langdon hurried up the stairs behind her. Before he could say a word, she had grasped the handle and pulled. Langdon held his breath. The door didn't budge.
There must be another entrance, Vittoria said. Probably, Langdon said, exhaling. But Olivetti will be here in a minute. It's too dangerous to...
Vittoria turned, her eyes blazing.
If there's another way in, there's another way out.
Langdon knew she was right. The alley on the right side of the church was pinched and dark, with high walls on both sides. Langdon and Vittoria hurried into the dimness. They had gone about 15 yards down when Vittoria tugged Langdon's arm and pointed. Langdon saw it too. Up ahead was an unassuming wooden door with heavy hinges. Langdon recognized it as the standard Porta Sacra, a private entrance for clergy. Vittoria hurried to the door, but it too was locked. She looked down the remainder of the alley.
You think there's another entrance?
Langdon doubted it.
Maybe recessed in the rear bastion. More of an escape route than an entrance.
Vittoria was already on the move. Somewhere a bell began ringing 8 o'clock. At the base of the rear wall, a stone bulwark jutted out, concealing a narrow grotto, a kind of compressed passageway, cutting directly into the foundation of the church. Vittoria knelt and peered into the tunnel.
"Let's check the door, see if it's open."
Langdon opened his mouth to object, but Vittoria took his hand and pulled him into the opening. He moved past her into the dark.
"Careful,"
he called over his shoulder. The tunnel narrowed slightly, and Langdon slowed his pace. He sensed Vittoria close behind him. As the wall curved left, the tunnel opened into a semicircular alcove. Oddly, there was a faint light here. In the dimness, Langdon saw the outline of a heavy wooden door.
"Uh-oh," he said.
"Locked?" Vittoria asked.
"It was,"
Langdon pointed. Lit by a shaft of light coming from within, the door hung ajar, its hinges splintered by a wrecking bar still lodged in the wood. They stood a moment in silence. Then, in the dark, Langdon felt Vittoria's hands on his chest, groping, sliding beneath his jacket.
"Relax, Professor," she said. "I'm just getting the gun."
The interior of Santa Maria del Popolo was a murky cave in the dimming light.
The main sanctuary was an obstacle course of torn-up flooring, brick pallets, mounds of dirt, wheelbarrows, and even a rusty backhoe. Nothing moved. Dead silence. Vittoria held the gun out in front of her with both hands. Langdon checked his watch, 8:04 p.m.
"We're crazy to be here," he thought. "It's too dangerous."
But he felt guilt-ridden over the blunder that had cost everyone their chance at the Pantheon.
"So,"
Vittoria whispered,
"where is this Kiji Chapel?"
Langdon gazed through the dusky ghostliness toward the back of the cathedral and studied the outer walls.
"It could be any of those draped recesses," he said.
"No way to know which is the Kiji without looking inside every one." It took them 2 minutes to find it. When they did, drawing aside the plastic drape, Langdon was in awe, transported for an instant to another world. Finished entirely in chestnut marble, the Kiji Chapel was breathtaking. Langdon's trained eye devoured it in gulps. It was as earthly a chapel as he could fathom, almost as if Galileo and the Illuminati had designed it themselves. Overhead, the domed cupola shone with a field of illuminated stars and the 7 astronomical planets. Below that, the 12 signs of the zodiac, pagan, earthly symbols rooted in astronomy. The zodiac was also tied directly to earth, air, fire, and water, the quadrants representing power, intellect, ardor, emotion. "Earth is for power," Langdon recalled.
"I don't see a cardinal," Vittoria whispered. "Or an assassin."
She stepped in ahead of Langdon, then turned and pointed.
"Robert,"
Vittoria blurted, her voice cracking. "Look!" Sneering up at them from the floor was the image of a skeleton. An intricately detailed marble mosaic depicting death in flight. It was not the image, however, that had turned Langdon's blood cold. It was the fact that the mosaic was mounted on a circular stone that had been lifted out of the floor like a manhole cover and was now sitting off to one side of a dark opening in the floor.
"Demon's hole,"
Langdon gasped. He had been so taken with the ceiling, he had not even seen it. Tentatively, he moved toward the pit. The stench coming up was overwhelming. Vittoria put a hand over her mouth.
"Che puzza!"
"Effluvium," Langdon said. "Vapors from decaying bone." He breathed through his sleeve as he leaned out over the hole, peering down.
"I can't see a thing."
You think anybody's down there?
No way to know.
Vittoria motioned to the far side of the hole, where a rotting wooden ladder descended into the depths. Langdon shook his head.
Like hell.
Maybe the workman left a flashlight outside. She sounded eager for an excuse to escape the smell. I'll look.
Careful,
Langdon warned.
We don't know for sure that the Hashashin...
But Vittoria was already gone. Langdon closed his eyes and waited, forcing his pupils to dilate so he could see better in the dark. When he opened his eyes again, a pale, muted figure hovered below in the darkness. Langdon shivered but fought the instinct to pull out. Suddenly, a long shadow materialized over him. Startled, Langdon scrambled up.
"Look out!"
someone exclaimed behind him. Before Langdon could turn, he felt a sharp pain on the back of his neck. He spun to see Vittoria twisting a lit blowtorch away from him, the hissing flame throwing blue light around the chapel. Langdon grabbed his neck.
"What the hell are you doing?"
"I was giving you some light," she said. "You backed right into me." Langdon glared at the portable blowtorch in her hand.
"Best I could do," she said. "No flashlights."
Langdon rubbed his neck. "I didn't hear you come in." Vittoria handed him the torch, wincing again at the stench of the crypt.
"You think those fumes are combustible?"
"Let's hope not." He took the torch and moved slowly toward the hole. The crypt was circular and about 20 feet across. 30 feet down, the glow found the floor. The ground was dark and mottled. Earthy. Then Langdon saw the body. Vittoria saw it too and headed for the rickety ladder.
"I'm going down."
Langdon caught her arm.
"No, it's dangerous. I'll go."
This time Vittoria didn't argue. Chinita Macri was mad. She sat in the passenger seat of the BBC van as it idled at a corner on Via Tomacelli. Gunther Glick was checking his map of Rome, apparently lost.
"Conclave started an hour ago," Chinita moaned. "What if the cardinals come to a decision while we're gone?"
Glick didn't seem to hear.
"I think we go to the right here."
He began to pull out onto the narrow street before them.
"Look out!" Macri yelled.
Glick slammed on the brakes and avoided entering the intersection just as a line of 4 Alfa Romeos appeared out of nowhere and tore by in a blur. Once past, the cars skidded, decelerating, and cut sharply left 1 block ahead, taking the exact route Glick had intended to take. He hit the accelerator and peeled out after the cars.
"Something tells me you and I, Macri, are not the only ones going to church right now."
The descent was slow. Langdon dropped rung by rung down the creaking ladder, deeper and deeper beneath the floor of the Chigi Chapel. Vittoria's outline was still visible above, holding the blowtorch inside the hole, lighting Langdon's way. The walls were honeycombed with shelf-like openings, burial niches, all filled with skeletons. Langdon was relieved to feel the final rung give way to the spongy earth at the bottom. In the gloom, the image he had seen from above was a white, fleshy outline facing the other direction. Advancing through the murkiness of the crypt, Langdon tried to make sense of what he was looking at. As he drew nearer, he realized the man was very short. Too short.
"What's happening?"
Vittoria called from above, shifting the light. Langdon didn't answer. He was now close enough to see it all. With a tremor of repulsion, he understood. The man was buried up to his waist in the earth, stripped naked, his hands tied behind his back with a red cardinal sash. His head lay backward, eyes toward the heavens, as if pleading for help from God himself.
"Is he dead?"
Vittoria called. Langdon moved toward the body.
"He's dead, all right," Somebody stuffed a fistful of dirt down his throat. He suffocated.
Dirt, Vittoria said. As in, earth?
Langdon did a double take as he lowered his eyes to the body's midsection. There was a marking on the cardinal's chest, charred and oozing.
Earth,
he whispered, tilting his head to see the symbol upside down.
Earth.
Despite the soft glow of candlelight in the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortati was on edge. Conclave had officially begun, and it had begun in a most inauspicious fashion. Half an hour ago, at the appointed hour, Camerlengo Carlo Ventresca had entered the chapel. He walked to the front altar and gave opening prayer. Then he unfolded his hands and spoke to them in a tone as direct as anything Mortati had ever heard from the altar of the Sistine.
You are well aware, the Camerlengo said, that our four preferiti are not present in conclave at this moment. I ask in the name of His Late Holiness that you proceed as you must, with faith and purpose. May you have only God before your eyes.
Then he turned to go.
But,
one cardinal blurted out,
where are they?
The Camerlengo paused.
Have faith, he said.
Then he walked out of the room. Mortati had called for a vote. What else could he do? He read the ballots aloud, one after the other. Almost immediately he sensed this first vote would be failed. No consensus. After only 7 ballots, already 7 different cardinals had been named. The cardinals were waiting for their preferiti.
Nearly asphyxiated by fumes, Langdon struggled up the ladder toward the light at the top of the pit. Above him he heard voices, but nothing was making sense. His head was spinning with images of the branded cardinal. Suddenly the strong hands of 2 Swiss guards hooked him under the armpits and dragged him skyward. A moment later Langdon's head emerged from the demon's hole, choking and gasping for air. The guards dragged him over the lip of the opening, across the floor, and laid him down, back against the cold marble floor. For a moment Langdon was unsure where he was. Then the familiar bite of an angry tongue echoed inside the chapel, and he knew. Olivetti was screaming at Vittoria.
Why the hell didn't you figure that out in the first place?
The Chigi chapel was packed with Swiss guards. As Langdon's senses slowly returned, he saw Vittoria coming toward him. She knelt down, her face like an angel.
You okay?
Vittoria took his arm and felt his pulse. Her hands were tender on his skin.
Thanks.
Langdon sat up fully.
Olivetti's mad.
Vittoria nodded.
He has a right to be. We blew it. But we can get the killer next time.
She checked Langdon's watch.
Mickey says we've got 40 minutes. Get your head together and help me find the next marker.
Langdon staggered to his feet and steadied himself against the wall. Vittoria was dead right. If the marker were indeed here, and they could follow it to the next altar of science, they might have another chance to catch the killer. Vittoria moved closer.
I found out who the unknown Illuminati sculptor was. It was Bernini.
She paused.
The Bernini.
Langdon shook his head.
Vittoria, the Illuminati members referred to their secret artist as El Maestro Ignoto, the unknown master.
Yes, she said, unknown to them. Look at the sign behind you.
Langdon turned to the plaque. Art of the Chigi Chapel. While the architecture is Raphael's, all interior adornments are those of Gianlorenzo Bernini. Langdon now felt totally disoriented.
Bernini, he said. I never would have guessed. I know,
Vittoria said. He's so famous. But who other than a famous Vatican artist would have had the clout to put his artwork in specific Catholic chapels around Rome and create the Path of Illumination?
Langdon considered. But I don't see any sculptures, at least.
Vittoria cut him off by pointing toward Olivetti and some of his guards, who were gathered near the demon's hole.
Langdon followed the line of her hand to the far wall. At first he saw nothing. Then someone moved and he caught a glimpse. White marble. An arm, a torso, and then a sculpted face partially hidden in its niche. Two life-size human figures intertwined. Langdon's pulse accelerated. He moved across the room through the crowd. As he drew near, he stared up at the two faces of the sculpture and gasped.
"Who are they?" Vittoria urged, arriving behind him.
Langdon stood astonished.
"Habakkuk and the angel," he said, his voice almost inaudible.
The piece was a fairly well-known Bernini work that was included in some art history texts.
"Habakkuk," Vittoria said.
"Yes, the prophet who predicted the annihilation of the earth." Vittoria looked uneasy.
"You think this is the marker?"
Langdon nodded in amazement. Never in his life had he been so sure of anything.
Both the angel and Habakkuk had their arms outstretched and were pointing into the distance.
Langdon found himself suddenly smiling.
"Not too subtle, is it?"
Vittoria looked excited but confused.
"I see them pointing, but they're contradicting each other. The angel is pointing one way and the prophet the other."
Langdon chuckled. It was true, but he had already solved that problem. With a burst of energy, he headed for the door.
"Where are you going?" Vittoria called.
"I'm following the poem," he called over his shoulder. "The last line.
Let angels guide you on your lofty quest."
She gazed upward at the outstretched finger of the angel. Her eyes misted unexpectedly.
"Well, I'll be damned."
Parked in their BBC van, Gunther Glick and Chinita Macri still had no idea what it all meant, but she'd made sure the camera was rolling. As soon as they'd arrived, Chinita and Glick had seen a veritable army of young men pour out of the Alfa Romeos and surround the church. Some had weapons drawn. One of them, a stiff older man, led a team up the front steps of the church. The soldiers drew guns and blew the locks off the front doors. Macri heard nothing and figured they must have had silencers. Then the soldiers entered. A minute or two passed before Glick suddenly grabbed her arm.
"Over there! Focus!"
He pointed back to the church. Chinita swung the camera back to the top of the stairs.
"Hello there," she said, training on the man now emerging from the church. "Who's the dapper?"
Glick asked. Chinita moved in for a close-up.
"Haven't seen him before."
She tightened in on the man's face and smiled. "But I wouldn't mind seeing him again." Robert Langdon dashed down the stairs outside the church and into the middle of the piazza. It was getting dark now, the springtime sun setting late in southern Rome.
"Okay, Bernini," he said aloud to himself. "Where the hell is your angel pointing?"
He turned and examined the orientation of the church from which he had just come. He pictured the Chigi Chapel inside and the sculpture of the angel inside that. Without hesitation, he turned due west into the glow of the impending sunset.
"Southwest," he said, scowling at the shops and apartments blocking his view. "The next marker is out there. Air comes next."
Langdon urged himself to think. A Bernini sculpture that has something to do with air. He turned and headed back up the cathedral stairs. He was met beneath the scaffolding by Vittoria and Olivetti.
"Southwest," Langdon said, panting. "The next church is southwest of here."
Olivetti's whisper was cold. "You sure this time?"
Langdon didn't bite. Having ascended the church stairs, he was now higher and his view was better.
He still couldn't see anything, but he realized he was moving in the right direction. His eyes climbed the tower of rickety scaffolding above him. It rose 6 stories, almost to the top of the church's rose window, far higher than the other buildings in the square. He knew in an instant where he was headed. The scaffolding seemed less stable the higher Langdon climbed. His view of Rome, however, got better with every step. He pulled himself onto the last platform, brushed off the plaster, and stood up. The view was staggering. In the distance, on the very edge of Rome, Michelangelo's massive dome blotted the setting sun. St. Peter's Basilica, Vatican City. "Front stairs!" Glick exclaimed, pointing wildly through the windshield of the BBC van. "Something's going on!" Macri dropped her shot from Langdon back down to the main entrance. It seemed an army was emerging from the church. Like an American football team breaking from a huddle, the soldiers formed a straight line across the top of the stairs. Moving like a human wall, they began to descend. Behind them, almost entirely hidden by the wall, 4 soldiers seemed to be carrying something. Something heavy, awkward. Glick leaned forward on the dashboard. "Are they stealing something from the church?" Chinita tightened her shot even more, using the telephoto to probe the wall of men, looking for an opening. "One split second," she willed. "A single frame. That's all I need." Macri stayed with them, and it paid off. When the soldiers tried to lift the object into the trunk, she found her opening. Only for an instant, but long enough. Macri had her frame. Actually, it was more like 10 frames. "Call editorial," Janita said. "We got a dead body." Far away, at CERN, Maximilian Kohler maneuvered his wheelchair into Leonardo Vetra's study. With mechanical efficiency, he began sifting through Vetra's files. Not finding what he was after, Kohler moved to Vetra's bedroom. The top drawer of his bedside table was locked. Kohler pried it open with a knife from the kitchen. Inside, Kohler found exactly what he was looking for. Langdon swung off the scaffolding and dropped back to the ground. He brushed the plaster dust from his clothes. Vittoria was there to greet him. "No luck?" she said. He shook his head. "No churches. From here, the first one you hit is St. Peter's." Moving toward Olivetti, Langdon told him the situation. "What's wrong with St. Peter's?" One of the soldiers around Olivetti said. He had a deep scar under his left eye. "It's a church." Langdon shook his head. "Needs to be a public place. Hardly seems public at the moment." "But the line goes through St. Peter's Square," Vittoria added, looking over Langdon's shoulder. "The square is public." Langdon had already considered it. "No statues, though." "Isn't there a monolith in the middle?" She was right. There was an Egyptian monolith in St. Peter's Square. But he shook it off. "The Vatican's monolith is not by Bernini. It was brought in by Caligula, and has nothing to do with air. Besides, the poem says the elements are spread across Rome. St. Peter's Square is in Vatican City, not Rome."
"Depends who you ask," another guard interjected. Langdon looked up. "What?" "Always a bone of contention," the guard went on. "Most maps show St. Peter's Square as part of Vatican City. But because it's outside the walled city, Roman officials for centuries have claimed it as part of Rome."
"You're kidding," Langdon said. He had never known that.
"I only mention it," the guard continued, "because Commander Olivetti and Miss Vetra were asking about a sculpture that had to do with air."
Langdon was wide-eyed.
"And you know of one in St. Peter's Square?"
"I patrol past it every day," the guard said. "It's in the center, directly where that line is pointing. That's what made me think of it. It's not really a sculpture. It's more of a block."
Olivetti looked mad.
"A block?"
"Yes, sir. a marble block embedded in the square, at the base of the monolith. But the block is not a rectangle, it's an ellipse. And the block is carved with the image of a billowing gust of wind. He paused. Air, I suppose, if you wanted to get scientific about it.
Langdon stared at the young soldier in amazement. A relief? He exclaimed suddenly. A bas-relief?
I wasn't thinking in those terms. That tile you're talking about in St. Peter's Square is called the West Ponente, the West Wind. It's also known as Respiro di Dio.
Breath of God?
Yes, air. And it was carved and put there by the original architect.
Vittoria looked confused.
But I thought Michelangelo designed St. Peter's.
Yes, the Basilica, Langdon exclaimed, triumph in his voice. But St. Peter's Square was designed by Bernini.
As the caravan of Alfa Romeos tore out of Piazza del Popolo, everyone was in too much of a hurry to notice the BBC van pulling out behind them. As they crossed the open expanse of St. Peter's Square on foot, Langdon and Vittoria held hands.
To the obelisk?
Vittoria asked. Langdon nodded, arcing left across the piazza.
Time?
Vittoria asked, walking briskly but casually.
Five of.
Vittoria said nothing, but Langdon felt her grip tighten. He was still carrying the gun. He hoped Vittoria would not decide she needed it. As they neared the obelisk, Vittoria slowed. She exhaled heavily, as if coaxing Langdon to relax along with her. Langdon made the effort, lowering his shoulders and loosening his clenched jaw. Gunther Glick watched from the shadows of the pillars surrounding St. Peter's Square. On any other day, the man in the tweed jacket and the woman in khaki shorts would not have interested him in the least. They appeared to be nothing but tourists enjoying the square. But today was not any other day. He looked out across the square and saw Macri. The tape she had shot earlier of the naked body dumped in the trunk was playing at this very moment on the VCR transmitter back in the van. Glick knew the images were sailing over his head right now, en route to London. He wondered what editorial would say. Langdon saw what he was looking for a good 10 yards before they reached it. Through the scattered tourists, the white marble ellipse of Bernini's West Ponente stood out against the gray granite cubes that made up the rest of the piazza. Vittoria apparently saw it too, her hand tensed. As they drew nearer, everything seemed forbiddingly normal. Tourists wandered, nuns chatted along the perimeter of the piazza, a girl fed pigeons at the base of the obelisk. Langdon refrained from checking his watch. He knew it was almost time. The relief when they saw it was elliptical, about 3 feet long and carved with a rudimentary face, a depiction of the west wind as an angel-like countenance. Gusting from the angel's mouth, Bernini had drawn a powerful breath of air, blowing outward, away from the Vatican.
"I think someone's following us," Vittoria said. "Come on."
Langdon looked up.
Where?
She moved both of them a good 30 yards before speaking. She pointed up at the Vatican as if showing Langdon something on the dome. The same person has been behind us all the way across the square.
You think it's the Hashashin? Langdon asked.
Vittoria shook her head. Not unless the Illuminati hires women with BBC cameras. Suddenly, the bells of St. Peter's began their deafening clamor. As the echo of the ninth bell faded away, a peaceful silence descended across the square. Then, the little girl began to scream. Langdon was the first to reach her. The terrified youngster stood frozen, pointing at the base of the obelisk where a shabby, decrepit drunk sat slumped on the stairs. Langdon felt an upsurge of dread as he dashed toward the invalid. There was a dark, widening stain spreading across the man's rags, fresh, flowing blood. Then, it was as if everything happened at once. The old man seemed to crumple in the middle, tottering forward. Langdon lunged, but he was too late. The man pitched forward, toppled off the stairs, and hit the pavement face down, motionless. Langdon dropped to his knees. Victoria arrived beside him. A crowd was gathering.
Swiss guards appeared from out of nowhere, shouting orders, racing after an unseen assassin.
Nearby, a tourist explained that only minutes ago, a dark-skinned man had been kind enough to help this poor, wheezing, homeless man across the square, even sitting a moment on the stairs with the invalid before disappearing back into the crowd. Langdon looked around wildly. As he did, he saw her. The woman who had been following them earlier was crouched nearby. Her BBC video camera was shouldered, aimed, and running. She and Langdon locked eyes, and he knew she'd gotten it all. Then, like a cat, she bolted. Chinita Macri was on the run. She had the story of her life. Her video camera felt like an anchor as she lumbered across St. Peter's Square, pushing through the gathering crowd. As she hurried in the direction of the BBC van, a young man with a decidedly militaristic air emerged from the crowd before her. Their eyes met, and they both stopped. Like lightning, he raised a walkie-talkie and spoke into it, and then he moved toward her. Macri wheeled and doubled back into the crowd, her heart pounding. As she stumbled through the mass of arms and legs, she removed the spent video cassette from her camera. Cellulose gold, she thought, tucking the tape under her belt flush to her backside and letting her coattails cover it. Click! Where the hell are you? Another soldier appeared to her left, closing in. Macri knew she had little time. She banked into the crowd again. Yanking a blank cartridge from her case, she slapped it into the camera. Then she prayed. She was 30 yards from the BBC van when the two men materialized directly in front of her, arms folded. She was going nowhere. Film, one snapped. Now! Suddenly, the unthinkable happened. Someone in the crowd was groping under her coat. Macri felt the video yanked away from her. She wheeled, but swallowed her words. Behind her, a breathless Gunther Glick gave her a wink and dissolved back into the crowd. In London, a BBC technician ejected a video cassette from a satellite receiver unit and dashed across the control room floor. She burst into the office of the editor-in-chief, slammed the video into his VCR, and pressed play. As the tape rolled, she told him about the conversation she had just had with Gunther Glick in Vatican City. In addition, BBC photo archives had just given her a positive ID on the victim in St. Peter's Square. When the editor-in-chief emerged from his office, he was ringing a cowbell. Everything in editorial stopped.
Live in five, the man boomed. On-air talent to prep. Media coordinators, I want your contacts online. We've got a story we're selling, and we've got film.
Victoria Vetra sipped a glass of water and nibbled absently at some tea scones just set out by one of the Swiss guards. The office of the Pope was bustling now, echoing with tense conversations. Captain Rocher, Commander Olivetti, and half a dozen guards assessed the damage and debated the next move. Robert Langdon stood nearby, staring out at St. Peter's Square. He looked dejected. Victoria walked over.
Ideas?
He shook his head.
Scone?
His mood seemed to brighten at the sight of food.
Hell yes, thanks.
He ate voraciously. The conversation behind them went quiet subtly when two Swiss guards escorted Camerlengo Ventresca through the door. If the Chamberlain had looked drained before, Victoria thought, now he looked empty.
What happened? The Camerlengo said to Olivetti. From the look on the Camerlengo's face, he appeared to have already been told the worst of it. Olivetti gave the facts with flat efficacy as the Camerlengo crossed the room and sat heavily behind the Pope's desk.
We've lost two battles, Signore, Olivetti summed up. But we're winning the war. The Illuminati had intended to turn this evening into a media circus. So far, we have thwarted their plan. Captain Rocher tells me he is making excellent headway on the antimatter search.
Captain Rocher stepped forward in his red beret. Vittoria thought he looked more human somehow than the other guards, stern, but not so rigid. Rocher's voice was emotional and crystalline, like a violin.
I am hopeful we will have the canister for you within an hour, Signore.
Captain, the Camerlengo said, excuse me if I seem less than hopeful, but I was under the impression that a search of Vatican City would take far more time than we have.
A full search, yes. However, after assessing the situation, I am confident the antimatter canister is located in one of our white zones. Those Vatican sectors accessible to public tours, the museums and St. Peter's Basilica, for example. We have already killed power in those zones and are conducting our scan.
As Rocher continued talking, Vittoria looked at Langdon.
We need a reference book, she said. An index of Bernini's work. If we can scan titles, maybe something will jump out.
Langdon shrugged.
Yeah. He took a step toward Olivetti. I need a list of all Bernini's work. How about the Vatican Museum? They must have...
There's another reference, Olivetti interrupted. Vittoria felt a flicker of optimism.
Where?
The commander did not reply. He took the guard with the scar aside and spoke in hushed tones. The guard seemed uncertain, but nodded obediently. When Olivetti was finished talking, the guard turned to Langdon.
This way, please, Mr. Langdon. It's 9:15. We'll have to hurry.
Langdon and the guard headed for the door. Vittoria started after them.
I'll help.
Olivetti caught her by the arm.
No, Miss Vedra. I need a word with you.
His grasp was authoritative. Langdon and the guard left. Olivetti's face was wooden as he took Vittoria aside. But whatever it was Olivetti had intended to say to her, he never got the chance. His walkie-talkie crackled loudly.
Comandante!
Everyone in the room turned. The voice on the transmitter was grim.
I think you better turn on the television.